This is the United Podcast Network.
This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Thank you, and welcome to another episode of Voices in Validation, brought to you by the IVT Network. Today, we will go back to basics and get some facts straight. All processes and products come with some level of inherent risk. In life science, the goal is always to reduce risk as much as possible, ensuring patient safety to the maximum extent. The systematic process for the assessment, controls, communication, and review of risks across the product lifecycle is the focus of a new series of podcasts called Risk Revolution that I'm happy to introduce to you now. Today, we're going to take a look at risk management in a broader context and get some facts straight. To help us do that, we have our Risk Revolution team of Lori Richter and Nuala Kalnan, as well as special guest Chris Flask. So welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to have you today. And for our listeners, I want you to each just take a brief moment to introduce yourselves. Lori, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. So I'm Lori Richter. I'm the Director of Risk Management at Ultragenyx right now. I've probably spent the last 12 years of my career doing some elements of risk management, both in quality risk management and business continuity management and strategic risk management as well. So I enjoy the topic, and I'm looking forward to doing more of these podcasts as well.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lori. Nuala?
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. My name is Nuala Kalnan. I am the CEO of BioPharmXL, and I'm based all the way across the pond here in Dublin, Ireland. And I'm not even going to put a number on the number of years that I've been working with risk and risk-based approaches. But as well as being a practitioner in the field and working, in the pharmaceutical industry, I am also a research fellow with TU Dublin, Technological University of Dublin, and we run a range of risk research projects and at master's and PhD level here in Dublin.
Great. Thanks, Nuala. And Chris?
Hi, my name is Chris Flask. I am the business capability owner for warehousing for Roche globally, basically looking at all the affiliate and manufacturing warehouses all over the globe to make sure that they're operating in a very interconnected and safe way. I've had over 20 years of experience in pharma, dealing with manufacturing and supply chain and looking at business continuity management as well as quality risk management in a number of different areas. So really happy to be here today and discuss this topic.
Great. Thanks so much, Chris. Yeah, we definitely look forward to your insights on the supply chain, on the supply chain issues, right? So let's dive right in and talk about quality risk management. ICHQ9 is all about quality risk management, but you want to have the industry look at risk in a different way, Nuala. Tell us more about the idea of taking the Q, so the quality piece, out of QRM.
Yeah, well, we're going right with the title, Stacey, right up there with the revolutionizing risk in terms of suggesting that we might want to take the Q out of QRM. You know, both Lori and I are practitioners and active researchers in the field. And you know, we see every day opportunities to improve the maturity and the practice of risk management as it's practiced around the industry. Specifically in regard to the taking the Q out of the QRM, we've recognized that, you know, since the ICH was published, 15 years ago, it's largely been managed and executed under the remit of the quality unit. Now there are, you know, multitude of disciplines involved in managing risk. But largely speaking, the QRM aspects of it are managed by the quality unit. But, you know, we know that within a regulated industry, everything that everybody does impacts on our ability to deliver high quality products on time in full. So whether this is looking at the, you know, the supply chain management, and Chris is, we're delighted to have Chris here with us today as an expert in that field. You know, whether we're looking at critical suppliers or the logistics associated with moving our medicines, or indeed, you know, business continuity management, which is closely linked to that supply chain management as well. And that's really, you know, a discipline where you can be building organizational resilience and, more importantly, perhaps preventing potential issues from occurring. And then, you know, right where we are now is in the middle of a pandemic. Who knew last Christmas that we would be having the year that we're having? But, you know, so there's the whole discipline of crisis management that comes into play, whether that's a pandemic or whether it's managing a hurricane response down in Puerto Rico.
Absolutely.
Not to mention, you know, a local fire or flood, or, you know, bringing out a critical supplier. And finally, we get to the piece that we tend to talk about a lot, which is the QRM, which is really looking at how to prevent and control quality defects from arising in our products. But our view is that all of these need to work together holistically in order to get the right product delivered to the right patient at the right quality, at the right time, and hopefully at the right price that suits both the patient and the business. So we would like to see a more diverse range of skills, knowledge, and opinions, different perspectives coming into play in not only doing the risk assessments, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later on, but really looking at how we can prevent these issues from arising in the first place in terms of these risks. So that's a huge issue for us. And we hope it's possible to reduce and prevent these risks, not only when we're asking questions around product quality and compliance in our quality risk assessments, but to align that in terms of all the other risk sciences and risk activities that are going on in the business. And aligning that means looking at similar approaches, similar language sets, maybe even similar scoring systems or rationales. And I think we could do a lot better by joining the dots. So perhaps it's not just about taking the Q out of QRM. It may be actually broadening that Q, and I think Chris is going to talk to this later, to embrace all of those disciplines, looking at the quality and effectivity of the product as it reaches the patient and ensuring that it's fit for its intended purpose.
Right. So definitely quality is still an important part. We're not we kind of joked and say we're taking the Q out of QRM, but obviously the quality has to be there. But we're taking more of a 40,000 foot view of risk management across the life cycle in all departments and making sure that everybody is working towards the same goals and really just moving forward with their piece of the risk management to produce the highest quality products. And so if we focus on risk management in this more broad, in this broader context, as you mentioned, how will this change our risk reporting, Lori?
Yeah, so that, I really love this topic. It's something Nuala and I are both very passionate about, just because I think when ICHQ9 came about, a lot of us focused on that compliance piece of it, making sure we were identifying those quality and compliance risks. But if we take it now into that broader context, I really think we're driving more towards the true intent of ICHQ9, which was not just to secure that product quality piece, but it was actually to ensure supply to the patient. And I think by supply to the patient, they mean an effective quality product to that patient, which is beyond just those quality elements we're looking at, right? We need to look at suppliers. We need to look at the strategy of the company to ensure success for that patient to receive that product. So I think what we're suggesting too is that when we're reporting risk, we're looking at that broader context so that decision makers and leadership can make a better holistic decision for that product, a better holistic decision for that company to ensure that, again, back to that supply to that patient. So I'm a huge advocate of risk registers that look beyond that compliance and quality piece, but encompass risks that affect the business in general. And I think Chris will speak to this. quality is a part of the business. We tend to want to always separate these two things as if they're distinctly different, and they are not. You know, at the end of the day, if we can't supply that safe, effective product to that patient, we certainly aren't going to be in business. So I think I'm advocating and have always encouraged that larger risk register that escalates up through the leadership of your company to ensure that there's a broader sense of decisions that are being made instead of, oh, I'm going to look at safety risk over here and I'm going to look at quality risk over here and somewhere there's supply chain. No, these decisions have to be made and looked across.
That makes total sense. And really, so what it sounds like then is that risk management really needs to be viewed as a business capability, not just a compliance requirement, right? We're not just checking off the boxes for the sake of checking off the boxes. And how are we failing to integrate this kind of thinking into our business capability? Chris, I'm going to give you an opportunity to kick us off with this.
Sure. Thank you. So as has been mentioned before by Lori and Nuala, there tends to be, you know, from my 20 years in operations, what I've tended to see over time is sort of this separation of church and state between quality and operations, right? That we in operations, we do our stuff, but we have to sort of, you know, pay attention to some things that are being told to us by this group over here called quality. When in fact, the activities and the expectations from this quality requirement are not separate from what we do. And that's where we tend to miss the opportunity to really leverage quality in our processes. And in that, I mean, if we think of an SOP simply as a listing of activities instead of a document designed to make sure that we have safe and effective products, we are just checking a box. And that's where we need to get away from to show that we've truly institutionalized the concept of quality risk management or quality into our production. As a supply chain expert, if I achieve the mission of getting medicine to a patient that needs it, but that medicine doesn't work or that medicine is unsafe, I've still failed. So, you know, understanding that all of these expectations within quality are really important for me to adhere to, not simply as a compliance expectation, but to make sure that what we're providing our patients is really going to achieve the intent of that medicine. And that's where I see a lot of opportunity to sort of step away. But what I will also mention that it's a bit of a double-edged sword. While it's important for me in operations to really understand the importance of that those quality expectations, it's also important for the folks developing those expectations to really think about, is this what we need to make sure that we have safe and effective product? Let's not over-engineer the systems. Let's not create, you know, overly conservative expectations simply for doing that. But let's partner with operations, let's be part of that and understand how to develop the best approach to allow both operations to succeed, to get safe and effective medicines to our patients, and not burden ourselves with a lot of unnecessary administrative overhead.
Sure. And that makes total sense, of course. And you obviously, you know, even though your expertise is in supply chain and you mentioned getting the drug to the patient, but you have to also have trust that all the other departments did their piece to produce a high quality product, and you feel good about sending it out the door and doing all that you can. Chris, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about supply chain maps and how these can help in managing risk to the patient.
Yeah, sure. And it's a great topic because I think it really illustrates some of the concepts that we're talking about here. When you think of a supply chain map and the expectation that we create this supply chain map, again, you may conceive of it as checking a box, right? It's a simple set of lines between different supply points that we have to document and put into a binder and put on a shelf or, you know, record in the system somewhere. But when you actually get down to why we do that and what's important about that, and again, how that can connect to some of our risk mitigation strategies, a whole new approach to how we do supply chain maps sort of becomes evident. So when you think about, okay, why do we do that? Why do we create these connections between different supply points? You need to be able to show, especially if you've got direct materials that are coming in from, who knows what region under which regulatory requirements, and your manufacturing is happening in a different part of the world. Your drug substance and your drug product are separated by continents. There's a lot of movement that goes in between those. And so if you haven't validated your transportation lanes, if you haven't managed your cold chain expectations, then again, you may still be moving things around, but at the end of the day, you don't have safe and effective products because you've got temperature excursions or whatever. So understanding that you need to first create realistic supply chain maps, and you need to be able to show that you've got control of your supply chain between these two points. It is not an abstract thought. It's an actual operational requirement. But on the other side of that, if you don't work with your operations teams to understand what are your possibilities in that supply chain map, you may miss the opportunity to design risk management and business continuity management into that by creating secondary hubs for storage, for example. And then in a time of crisis, if you haven't created that opportunity, you may not have the validated shipping lanes that allows you to move materials. And this has happened, you've got fires, we're here in California, you have fires coming up the hill towards your manufacturing plant. You need to get that API out of that plant to some other safe location, and you've got no option. And you have no option because perhaps the person developing that supply chain map didn't really partner with operations to understand what else do we need to have in here to allow us to manage things that are happening. And then you're left scrambling, and then you're putting patients at risk because you're moving stuff in a way that you don't have control. So I think, that really illustrates not only the opportunity of a supply chain map, but some of the pitfalls you may fall into if you don't think of it as a real operational tool.
It sounds like a valuable tool, right? And especially when we are faced with shortages due to the pandemic and or, natural disasters like the wildfires. But we have hurricanes this time of year. Anything can happen. And I really want to focus in a little bit more on the pandemic and managing for a crisis and ask you what you see or can you define what the risks that you're seeing in the pharma supply chain landscape right now with respect to the COVID-19 vaccine race? We are focused a lot as an industry on a vaccine, and how is that impacting, if you will, the supply chain?
Yeah, that's a great question, and everybody who's in supply chain right now is seeing some of this. And it's been very interesting. So obviously, once the pandemic started back in March, one of the first impacts that we saw in supply chain was you can imagine, and a lot of people don't realize this, you can imagine with all of the restrictions on movement, domestic flights, international flights all stopped, right? Most of the airlines were cutting their commercial flights down by 50% or shutting down entirely. And what folks don't realize is quite a bit of pharma, both API and finished goods, flies in what's called belly freight, which is the freight capacity in commercial airlines. It's not chartered flights or DHL or UPS. It's United Airlines or Lufthansa, and they cut their flight routes, right? So we're left scrambling. How do we get this drug substance from the U.S. to Europe or to Japan? And it was a difficult time. You're starting to see another spike where you can imagine these flights would start becoming restricted again. And on this end of it, now you've got that looming opportunity that a vaccine is going to be released. And somehow we're going to have to get 300 million doses out to different people or 7 billion doses out to the world on some form of flight. And many of these vaccines are going to require a cold chain. The temperatures that are being listed now would generally require dry ice. There's really no other option for that. And there isn't a lot of capability. You know, another aspect of the of that constraint, so if we're going to use dry ice, the producers for dry ice need to have the capacity to not only produce what they've been for both food and for pharma, but now for this incredible surge. And it's not something, dry ice isn't something that you can produce and store. And, you know, it's made every day for the need that you have. So how do we bring that production online? So what I see is both a reduction in freight capability internationally, as well as that limit on dry ice production. Another issue is a lot of the liquid carbon dioxide used to make dry ice comes from ethanol production used to make fuel. Well, people aren't driving as much, so they've shut down a lot of the production capability, and we're not getting the carbon dioxide. So it's just this sort of perfect storm. So from a, if and I am, you know, if you're in supply chain management relying on something like dry ice right now, you need to be thinking, what's your backup plan? How are you going to get these materials if you can't get freight and you can't get dry ice? And additionally, for planes, you have a limited amount of dry ice you can put on a plane because off-gassing can affect the pilots. And so even if you had dry ice, you may not be able to get it on a plane. So these are all the things that we're thinking about right now. How do we make sure that we have routes to bring our materials, you know, in across the country or across the world for further production?
It sounds like a very complicated, definitely a complicated problem to solve, and one that's ongoing. And so maybe just quickly, because we talked about the supply chain maps and now we're talking about these incredible challenges that are only made larger because of the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the pieces that's impacted. Can you just give us an example of how you might use your supply chain map to sort of figure this stuff all out ahead of time? Or in real time, maybe.
So, you know, one of the things that we've been in discussions, certainly since we looked at, and since we've experienced some of the issues in the early part of the pandemic, is do we need to look at our supply chain maps and start talking about those transatlantic movements, right? So, you know, we've got certain production that happens here in the US, certain production that happens in the EU. Do we need to rethink that and perhaps put some, you know, these nodes close to each other in the US and different movements, you know, across that don't require dry ice, for example? You can move finished goods in 2 to 8 and you don't need dry ice. So, you know, you can minimize your need for those kinds of constrained resources by changing how you've set up your supply chain map. But, you know, at this point, since those sorts of considerations may not have been, you know, realized or taken into account beforehand, right now we'd be left scrambling, but we do need to be thinking about that in the future. The other piece is there's a lot of work going on right now in the industry around shipping by boat, basically using sea freight. The entire sea freight industry has sort of remade itself in the last 8 months to be able to become a more credible mode for transportation for pharma. They have a huge initiative going on called the Poseidon Initiative to create that opportunity. So how do we tie that mode of transportation into our supply chain map? So those are the things we're addressing right now. And those are the things that I would encourage other supply chain owners and supply chain professionals to be looking at when designing their supply chain maps.
Definitely. I mean, we have seen throughout the pandemic a need for us to be better as an industry in terms of our planning for disasters. And this is just one example of that. And it certainly sounds like it requires some real outside the box thinking. So, I mean, you know, thanks for sharing that example with us. I think that's very helpful. Lori, I have a question for you now that we've discussed the idea of treating risk management as an enabler to the business and ensuring the patient receives a quality product that is effective in treating the indication. What are your recommendations regarding preparation for risk assessment activities so that we can sort of start to figure out where these risks lie, you know, before they're upon us? And I know we covered this at a high level the last time we talked, but I'm hoping we can dig a little bit deeper this time.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. Well, first, I want to comment that I get really excited when I was hearing Chris talk about all these different risk identifications, because I appreciate the creativity that goes behind solving some of these potential risks. And I think that's the part I enjoy the most, you know, about risk management. And I've appreciated seeing so much that humans can come up with during a stressful time like we're in right now. There's been so much creativity flowing, I think, across the globe. But let's talk about planning and preparing for risk assessment. First and foremost, Nuala and I are very passionate about the difference between a risk management plan and preparing for a risk assessment. So a risk management plan is often used in the industry in terms of documenting the sort of structure behind what you're going to do to execute this risk assessment, who the key players are, the tool that was used. It's a very formal document. But what we want to focus on is preparing for the risk assessment. And when I teach risk management courses, I spend an entire day just on teaching people how to prepare. Right. And I actually tell people that's the part you should spend the most time with, because if you prepare and get the team set up well, the execution of the risk assessment goes so much better. So let's talk about some key steps. First and foremost, I wanted to differentiate between a couple of roles and responsibilities that I typically call out when I'm preparing for a risk assessment. Is one, I do a little smaller prep as a facilitator myself with what I call the risk lead. Risk lead is commonly used, not at every company, but typically we refer to them as the person that sort of owns the operation or has skin in the game for the process that's being assessed. I highly, highly recommend that role, and that that role is partnered with a separate person who's a facilitator. Now, a lot of times, a lot of companies are small and there's only so many people, so they're sort of one and the same. The challenge with that is if I'm the risk lead and the facilitator, I may not be able to see beyond and ask those difficult questions because I own the process. And maybe I even designed it, right? Nuala and I are going to cover bias, which is a whole other topic in a separate conversation, how that can be a very big problem in risk assessment. So having those two roles as two separate people working together to prepare for this risk assessment, I think makes the process go a lot smoother. The second piece then is, what's my problem statement? What am I truly trying to understand? And I like to use the words understand instead of solve, because if I go in with this open mind of, I'm trying to understand, I'm curious about something, then I'm open-minded and I'm not already solution-driven, right? Which a lot of times the agencies, the health authorities, see risk assessments as a solution to something so that I don't have to do it, right? Oh, I did a risk assessment, now I have reduced testing, right? So I like to drive the problem statement more from, what am I seeking to understand, right? What am I trying to draw clarification from? Then I like to draw a risk question. That's something I don't see broadly used in the industry, but it really should be, because it's really posing the, what's the question I'm seeking to clarify using risk? And that question can start out with, what are the risks associated with? Or what are the quality risks, if I'm really focused? But remember, we're broadening that cue, hopefully, right? So that risk question narrows that problem statement just a little bit more. It sort of takes it in a little bit more. And then the piece that's going to refine it even more is the scope. So what's in scope of this risk assessment? And then more importantly, what's out of scope of this risk assessment? Because if I don't define the out of scope, pretty soon my risk assessment is 300 line items long and it's an FMEA from hell, right? So
and nobody wants to pay attention to it at that point.
No, trust me, I've facilitated them. So really defining that out of scope is almost more imperative sometimes than what's in scope. The last thing I would say about those three components that's most important is they are not static. They're always going to be reevaluated. And in fact, I would highly recommend you put those on a giant piece of paper when we can all go back into conference rooms one day and post that on the wall, right?
Right.
Because I'm facilitating virtual right now, I'm asking all of my subject matter experts to keep that on the side of their laptop so they remember what we're doing. And we're always going back and going, is that in scope or is that out of scope when we're getting a little challenged with something?
Right.
And then risk scoring definitions. So I wanted to draw back to that question you had asked me originally today, is that whole idea of broadening the look across risk. So when we're looking at the risk scoring definitions, let's try to standardize those across the site as well, or company as well. And that was one of my big initiatives in my current role, is to standardize looking across a lot of different types of risks, even though there may be different definitions. Numerically, we're looking at those the same, so that when we make that final decision, what's red over here in EH&S is also red over here in compliance and quality, and red over here in supply chain. So that when leadership's looking, they know that they're sort of balancing those high risks across all of those areas. So that's something that's really critical for the team to determine. Now, realize up until this point, I don't even have a team yet. Right? It's just me and one other person sort of building these things. So now I need my subject matter experts, and those must be cross-functional. And please, please do not get the person in the room who just started yesterday so because they have free time. So I'm always encouraging people, it must be an expert in that area, and they must have that critical thinking capability to look beyond and look at the potential that Chris was talking about. Who knew, right, that dry ice would potentially be an issue?
And so Lori, when you're building this team, so now you're looking for your subject matter experts, as you mentioned, give us an idea of who typically is in the room, or who you would like to see in the room, and,
yes,
and you know, how many folks, and like what titles, like who are we talking about?
Yes. Oh, such important question too, about the number of people. So please, I once facilitated a risk assessment that had 50 people in a ballroom.
You cannot get anything done with 50 people in a room. No.
No. So 5 to 7 people. If this is a large scope risk assessment, break out those sections so that maybe I have these 5 to 7 people for 2 hours, and then I'm going to switch topics and get a different 5 to 7 people that are subject matter experts. In terms of titles, I highly recommend that you do not have a decision maker in that room during that assessment. You really must have the operational level person, people in that room, because once that decision maker enters that room, good intention or not, that's going to change the folk that room. Right now, suddenly I'm looking to that person that maybe is higher than me in the hierarchy.
Gotcha.
To sort of justify my statements, right? Am I right or wrong? Maybe I hold back a little bit.
Yeah.
So be really careful about levels. And I know in our industry, we have lots of people that are vice presidents that are excellent operational experts, but they must remember their title influences that room still at the end of the day.
Yeah, I would think so, right? If you are fearful of saying something that, that might be critical of your processes or something,
yeah,
that, you know, happens on a day-to-day basis, it's going to be a lot harder to say that if your boss or your boss's boss is sitting in the room with you, right?
That's right. I mean, I have no problems getting myself in trouble, but others do.
So, that's a great point that you made, that you really don't want the decision makers there for this part of the process.
Right. But what I will say about the decision maker, to clarify, is that I really want them to also be informed, though, of what's going on in the process.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, that role does take accountability for the decisions. The subject matter experts are recommending these things.
Correct.
So keeping them informed, and maybe even saying, hey, here's some the red risks we've identified along the way outside of that meeting, I think is fantastic.
Yeah,
having the decision maker endorse the activity is also fantastic. Having them in the room is not a good idea.
Right. Did you have something to add to that?
Yeah, you know, just on those people things, and we're going to talk about culture, we'll mention it later, but you know, it's so correct, not just about worrying about, you know, what technical capabilities need to be in the room. And I love the way that Lori mentioned curiosity earlier on. It's so important. And, you know, we have to recognize from a human nature perspective, most of the folks that we're working with have, you know, emerged from a scientific or engineering background, perhaps, you know, or certainly some form of discipline that is engaged in problem solving. That's what their core job is, around problem solving. And even Laurie mentioned the fact that she loves solving problems and hearing about how Chris is solving his problems. We love that. But what happens with that is that we jump straight in, forget about all the prep that Laurie has just outlined, and start applying solutions before we've even understood the question. So that's where the curiosity really comes in. And so making sure that people are aware that it's totally fine. There is no wrong answer in a brainstorm around risk. There is no boundaries other than the scope of the risk question. Everything can be put on the table for discussion. And if you do happen to be only in the company 2 weeks, you may still have an insight and you should be made to feel comfortable. And that might be where the facilitator's role can come in, is to say, you know, well, newly, I know you're only new to the company, but is there anything that's occurring to you here that those of us who are so used to being in the weeds don't no longer see? So that curiosity and allowing them to be curious, that we're not trying to solve a problem in the first phases of this. We're trying to look at all of the potential areas that a failure or a risk could arise. And so by having that mindset, you end up with fewer kind of decision errors. And you also open up, you know, much more open communications, less defensiveness, and ultimately a better team performance. If you're saying this activity is actually about curiosity, it's not about applying a solution just yet. We'll get to that point once we've ranked the risks. We'll get to looking at risk controls, which is where we start to apply the solutions. But I think, you know, that's a really important aspect of getting off on the right foot, as Laurie has identified there.
And then, of course, once you go through this process, Laurie, and you have your assessment, we're not just taking it and putting it on the shelf, right? There's so much work to be done.
Yes. And we'll probably cover that in risk review. In another, that's a whole other 483 health authority landmine.
Long discussion, but I think, you know, I'd like to make that point, because a lot of times people go through this process in some way, and then they think, done with that. Like, let's just put it over here, you know, with all our SOPs that we never look at either. And and we're done. And so, you know, we will talk about that obviously in future episodes, but
But key point, Stacey, very well. And something that I see very often, sadly enough. So yes.
Well, thank you all for sharing some expertise with us today. As we get ready to close out, I want to transition a little bit to preview our next podcast topic with Risk Revolution, which is risk culture. And each of you have mentioned it a little bit. And of course, we're referring to the mindsets and the attitudes that everybody have in the company and bring to work each day. So in closing, I wanted to ask each panelist to close our session today by giving us a quick example of how you would describe a risk culture. Chris, I'm going to let you kick us off.
Sure. Thanks. And this is something that's kind of near and dear to my heart. I've worked with many teams and organizations around strategic change and cultural change. And one of the things that I've noted over time is that we tend to think of in this particular case, risk as a separate activity, right? That it's, we have our risk assessment, we have our binder. Laurie and I had a long debate once of whether I should keep my binder in my car or my house. You know, where am I? You know, I have a binder somewhere, right? But it's really more about what you do every day, what you do over time. And the analogy I like to use is the difference between bowling and curling, if you understand the sport of curling.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I've seen happen is people will come up in the example of a risk assessment, that's bowling, right? We come up, we throw the ball. The moment the ball leaves our hand, any control over the outcome of that is gone, right? We're done with it. We, you know, a leader has come up and said, we're going to have business continuity plans. We'll do our risk assessment. I have it on my binder on my shelf. We're good. We're safe. I tend to see it more like curling, which is as soon as the stone is thrown, that's when the actual real work happens all the time. So, you know, you're out there, you're changing the conditions in front of that stone to get it to your target. In this particular case, a a risk mitigated or risk managed operation. So that's what we need to be doing. We need to be understanding that this risk issue isn't something we solve by having our tabletop exercise, right? That, you know, how we do our hiring, how we do our training, how we develop our supply chain maps and our SOPs all need to have those elements of risk. So if I were to define where I would see that risk culture, it would be where it's fully integrated into our operations and our day-to-day activities and understood as a part of what we do versus this separate exercise that was done once and we're sort of done with it.
Thanks, Chris. I love the curling analogy. I mean, that really does gave me a visual that made so much sense.
Thank you.
Nuala.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to our next show on risk culture. And for me, it's really all about preventing and reducing risk, you know, shifting our mindsets away from the risk controls, controlling and mitigating risk. And yes, we do have to do that, but a far more effective way of ensuring that we don't hit a bump in the road is in preventing the instances of risk or reducing the frequency with which they occur. And we need to a more proactive approach around that. So, and particularly, that shouldn't just be reviewed or viewed as the remit of the QRM specialist. You know, as an industry, we are extremely reactive. You know, we're adrenaline junkies. We're great at fixing things, as we mentioned earlier on. We're superb fixers. We're not so great at preventing. And that's really, for me, where I would like to see, and for everyone to see, the reduction and prevention of risk as part of their job, in the same way, you know, that Deming and Crosby, you know, said that quality is everyone's job. For me, risk avoidance and risk prevention is everyone's job, and not just the person with the QRM in the title. So I would love to see that is, you know, that becomes part of everyone's daily vigilance, and that we're all about preventing risk. Now, we'll be talking about that in the next episode. And there's a lovely concept around the bow tie concept. And I'm sure Laurie and I will have lots to chat about on that next time out.
I'm sure you will. Laurie?
So I think my closing thought about risk culture is going back to that curiosity piece. I think encouraging that open mind that some people are afraid of risk, and risk actually comes with reward at times, especially in pharmaceuticals. The industry is risky, especially at the clinical level. We're trying new things to change people's lives. And so I think embracing that we understand what those risks are and that we're capable of managing them should bring people comfort. It brings me comfort to sit down and identify risk and think about it. Other people, it brings anxiety. But I think driving home that point of being curious is, I think it changes that mindset a little bit. So that's going to be sort of my mantra for 2021 as I move forward with my own risk management program is embracing the curiosity piece behind it.
For sure. And I mean, as you're speaking, I'm just thinking that some people do have that fear, mm-hmm. that anxiety around risk. And I think a lot of that does come from regulatory agencies, expectations, and maybe expectations of, you know, your boss. But there is a lot of pressure sometimes on some of these folks to make sure that they're compliant always. And so I really look forward to the discussion next time on this to talk about how we really can sort of reshape those mindsets and attitudes, you know, from the top down and from the bottom up, because it has to go both ways. So thank you all for sharing your thoughts on that. And as we close today, I want to end with just reviewing Risk Revolution's key takeaways for today. Nuala, can you help us with that?
Yeah, this is something I feel is our giveaway. Every episode, we're going to try and pick up on some key takeaways and include them in the podcast notes. So we're grateful that Chris was able to join us. It was so great to have that perspective from a supply chain. And seeing as we did talk so much about supply chain maps, I want to point to a JVT article that I co-authored in 2017 with one of our master's students here about de-risking the supply chain and how to design a supply chain map. So hopefully we'll be able to put a link to that in the, in the notes. And another one is just a little takeaway of a 5-step card that we produced for one of the Irish Biopharmachem associations here a couple of years ago about those preparatory steps that Laurie talked about.
So important.
Preparing for a risk assessment. So it's just a little print off card. You can fold it up and it can sit in your boardroom where you do your risk assessments. So hopefully some few little tips and takeaways as resources for our listeners.
Fantastic. Thank you. And we, of course, will include all of those in our show notes. So thank you again to Lori Anula, our Risk Revolution team, as well as Chris Flask, our special guest today. It's been great having you all here with us and sharing all of your insights and information. Also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen, and the Studio 21 Podcast Cafe team. Lastly, a big thanks to you, our valued listeners. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, especially in the area of risk management, we'd love to hear from you on that. And if you enjoyed today's episode, we ask you to subscribe in your podcast player of choice so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to share it with your friends, colleagues, and your online networks. For today's show notes and all of the great takeaways that Nuala just mentioned, please visit the podcast on www.ivtnetwork.com. We'll be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, stay healthy and safe.
The views and opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or callers of this program do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Studio 21, Podcast Cafe, the United Podcast Network, its partners or affiliates.